With the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, Republicans have effectively consolidated power for the next few decades on the Supreme Court, effectively gaining control of the judicial branch far into the future. At this point, they have control of all three branches of government on the federal level. The 33 governor's mansions that are lived in by Republicans effectively give them executive power at the local level in roughly 70% of the nation. 31 state governments are controlled by Republicans, with 26 states being totally controlled by Republicans compared to 8 for Democrats, and the rest have a combination of mismatching governors and legislators. By these measures, they have near total control of the American political establishment, with Democrats being oppositions virtually in name only. While it is true that this could change next month and Democrats could take control of the legislative branch, Republican power has still been locked in and will take years to unseat. In this episode of Lessons from the Screen, we're going to be talking about how the Republicans managed to go from the party of civil rights to the party of states' rights, which has become code for having the personal freedom to mistreat and abuse others in a lot of circles. This party, while only making up 25% of the population, controls the nation.
Lessons from the screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.
Welcome back to another episode of Lessons from the Screen, the show where we give you a review of whether or not any particular information you can get from any particular screen of any particular kind is worth your time. We waste our time, our energy, and our brain power so that you don't have to. You're welcome. Lessons from the Screen is sponsored by PAX Inc., a black activist advocacy and think tank organization with the purpose of increasing the quality of life for black people in America through education, a culture shift, and economics. You can check them out at www.pactsinc.org. That's paxinc.org. Go ahead and leave a review, leave a comment, get involved, take a donation, volunteer, become a member, take a survey, do whatever you can to support them because they're doing whatever they can to support you. And without further ado, I bring to you this episode of Lessons from the Screen, where we will be talking about the transformation of the Conservative Party from one branch to another and the strategy that they have used to galvanize their supporters and their base into taking control of the political establishment here in America. The Republicans have figured it out. They have figured out how to get people out of their homes and into the voters' booth. They have figured out which key issues motivate their base, and they have figured out how to trigger that base through those key issues when they need to in order to get the votes needed at the times that they need them. They have figured out how to make people feel like victims while sitting in the seats of power, and they have mastered the ability to make their people feel like warriors that truly embody the American spirit. These warriors that feel victimized and empowered are currently engaged in a war against an opponent that doesn't seem to realize nor care that they're getting slaughtered. But we aren't going to talk about those opponents right now. We're going to talk about these warriors. And it all started with the compromise of 1877. So for the sake of continuity, I'm going to, for the most part, be utilizing the terms conservatives and liberals. This is because they have reversed parties over the last 100 years. The conservatives went from being Democrats to being Republicans, and the liberals went from being Republicans to being Democrats. So because of this, and there were times where the two parties contained both conservatives and liberals, with not too much separating the parties. So with that being said, I feel like it's better to have this conversation if we relinquish the party names and all the contextual baggage that they bring with them and simply focus on the ideology of the people involved in the parties right now, which are conservatives and liberals. So with that being said, in 1876, with Reconstruction well underway following the United States triumph over the Confederate nation, there was a presidential election. It's always a presidential election. During Reconstruction, federal troops had been placed in former Confederate states to ensure that the law was obeyed and equal protections for all were given. It was during this period of time that blacks were voting in massive numbers, well over 90% in some areas, which was resulting in black judges, black legislators, black officials taking office throughout the South. It was also during this time that the Conservative Party found itself nearly destroyed in the South, which leads us back to that presidential election in 1876. During 1876, there was a presidential election that was so heavily contested that it threatened to plunge the country back into war. In 1877, there was a compromise struck, which has effectively become known as the Compromise of 1877. Extremely creative name. The compromise had a few major points in it for black people. The first was for the removal of federal troops from the former Confederate states. Now, troops had already been removed from much of the South, but still remained in a few states. Federal troops were, as I said earlier, in place to ensure the rights of black people in the South, amongst other things. The second major point for black people, and the final point to be mentioned here, although there were roughly 5 or 6 points total, but the second major point for black people, and the final point to be mentioned, was that the South wanted the freedom to deal with black people without interference from the North. The reasonings and the result of the final point are the story that we all know too well, the introduction of the black codes, of Jim Crow segregation, and of voter restrictions. So in exchange for a presidential seat and a reduction in political tensions, the North, the liberals, abandoned blacks in the South, and the Redeemers took control. What followed was a course of action so effective and efficient and thorough that black participation in elections dropped to less than 5% and has hardly recovered since. The political respectability of the 1900s was at the expense of black people, and with the reintroduction of minorities into politics again in the 1950s and 60s, we saw a reintroduction of political tensions and hostilities. This, along with failed regulation regarding federal protections for voting, is what saved the Conservative Party as a political group and consolidated their base in the South, a base that they have held ever since. But this was a Conservative Party that was different in some ways from the current Conservative Party. This was a Conservative Party that didn't necessarily have a problem with federal handouts, although they didn't like a large federal government. And while they did advocate for states' rights, personal freedoms, and choice, the party did not have church groups as a base. They weren't the party of the Christians. And at the time, Christian groups were liberal or progressive organizations. Starting in the 1960s, the Conservative Party would start to gain the identity that would carry forward into the present day. In 1963, or what would become known as the Year of Birmingham, racial issues began to take center stage as the civil rights movement that had started in the 40s and 50s was gaining national steam and global attention. Birmingham, Alabama became the center of that focus in America because the violence experienced in the city and because of various activities aimed at ending legal segregation. Like conservatives of the past, George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, emphasized the connection between states' rights and segregation, similar to the way the Confederate states emphasized the connection between states' rights and slavery. Keep this in mind when you hear someone say that the South didn't secede because of slavery. They seceded because of states' rights. The states felt it was their right to hold slaves and didn't appreciate the federal government intervening. They are contextually the exact same thing. When you say that the South seceded because of states' rights, or that the South seceded because of slavery, contextually the exact same thing. Going back to George Wallace, he used his position to fan the flames of discontent in speeches and in policy. He resisted federal efforts to integrate public schools, and he collaborated with the Triple KKK. It was another presidential election year. This time, Senator Barry Goldwater, a conservative in what at the time was a liberal party, progressive liberal party of Republicans, launched his presidential bid. While he voted in support of civil rights legislation as a senator, during his presidential primary campaign against the liberal governor of New York, Nelson Rockefeller, he seemingly performed an about-face. It was during this primary that the conservative party experienced a split. While they had traditionally been seated in the Republican Party, they were sharing that space with liberals that held the same party affiliation. The primary created what would become known as a Rockefeller Republican, liberal Republican, or a Goldwater Republican, conservative Republican. Goldwater went on to win his primary, making him the face of the Republican Party nationwide, and he campaigned heavily against the Civil Rights Act, using the states' rights argument and accusing the bill of federal overreach and a violation of personal freedoms held by individuals to do business with whom they choose. This position obviously appealed to Southern whites, making Goldwater the first Republican to win the South since Reconstruction and the Compromise of 1877. But where the Compromise of 1877 put a liberal in the White House, Goldwater, who had won the South, was a conservative. He ended up losing the election, but the conservative party was again reinvigorated with a new identity and sense of self on a national level, inspired by the campaign of Barry Goldwater. In 1968, another presidential election year saw conservatives further galvanized by the hippie movement of free love and drugs, which ran counter to traditional American ideals and culture. The civil rights movement was beginning to give way to the Black Power movement, which further incentivized conservatives along with the Vietnam War and the protests by many young people over American involvement. Through all of these activities, the Conservative Party was gaining its identity as the party of law and order. The party of the Southern white man and Southern white men were beginning to group together. In 1968, Richard Nixon initiated what is today known as the Southern Strategy. Nixon viewed the problem as being the blacks. Now you know why people used to get on Donald Trump for using the blacks. And he ran his presidential campaign on states' rights and law and order. Now it's important to remember that Nixon did not run the Southern Strategy effectively. An independent named George Wallace ran a political attack campaign directly against the civil rights movement and black activism. And as a result, Wallace and Nixon split the Southern vote. In 1972, however, Nixon ran a campaign that was harsh in the South and moderate elsewhere, and as a result, he won an overwhelming majority of Southern states and also won 18% of the black vote, thanks to him being viewed as a moderate outside of the South. He carried 49 states in 1972, so it has to be stated that the Southern strategy was not the only reason he won. He ran a national platform that included a specific regional strategy for courting white voters that felt alienated by Democrats. In 1970, the Conservative Party, with Nixon at the helm, ran a Southern strategy midterm, which was the first time in the midterm in the modern era of that Democrats was shown as permissive liberals. While the results weren't beneficial, they ended up losing seats instead of gaining them. It is a key milestone in party swaps because this is the moment that can be identified as the swap where the conservatives and liberals switch places between the Democrat and Republican parties. In 1970, this was also the first time that either party realized that Supreme Court nominations had a major impact on political attitudes, as the rejection of Nixon's Supreme Court nominee by a liberal Senate caused many conservatives to leave the Democratic Party in favor of the Republican Party. Nixon wanted a Supreme Court judge that would support his Southern strategy, and the liberals had defeated him. Now, the Southern strategy did not result in major sweeping changes immediately. The changes were more gradual in terms of political affiliation. But what the Southern strategy did was give the conservative party a party all their own, one that they didn't have to share with liberals. While black voters did begin voting Democratic at a clip of above 80% in the late 60s, early 70s, conservatives were still present in the Democratic Party. The shift in white voters had changed a lot slower than the shift in black voters. And we also have to remember that at this point, black voter disenfranchisement, again, had been so thorough that even with black voters completely shifting to another party, it didn't really pose that much of a political threat to a new and growing conservative party that was solidifying its ideology and its identity. In 1973, another bomb dropped. Abortion was made legal in the United States by a conservative Supreme Court ruling, 7-2 in favor. For more information on what that did, go listen to the show on the documentary entitled Reversing Roe, or go watch the documentary. But at those times, abortion was not viewed as a moral issue. It was viewed as a health issue. And so when you take that view, you begin to view abortion in a different light. But when abortion was made legal, a new trigger issue was created. The Catholic Church, which had opened the first abortion clinic, began to fight with itself, and the pro-life side came out the winner. Conservatives recognized this as an issue, and along with the knowledge gained during the Nixon Supreme Court appointment, began to bring the pro-life movement into the fold. The pro-life movement of evangelicals also found a friend in the racial politics of the conservative movement, as freedom academies, which were created by Southerners, Southern white people, who wanted to resist integration in public schools, were largely created by churches. And those freedom academies wanted federal subsidies for their schools. So they created private schools where white kids could go to school with white kids without having to worry about their parents having to concern themselves with black kids. Churches started these freedom academies, and they wanted government money to help run their school and support their school. But thanks to the civil rights movement, the government would not provide any federal funding to an organization that discriminated based on race. They wanted to get that overturned. They found an ally in the racial politics. With the passage of all these events, the modern Republican was born in the late 70s, early 80s, with a strongly defined base and a key set of issues. The white states' rights supporter that believed in limited federal government was Christian and was pro-life. This supporter was triggered anytime they felt their personal rights were being infringed upon by the federal government. And the federal government was doing a lot of infringing in their eyes. This is how the Second Amendment became and remains a key issue. This was also central to the pushback on the Affordable Care Act. The fact that it mandated insurance was a huge federal grab in the eyes of these people. Civil rights legislation was another example of federal overreach, especially with regards to dictating who a business could and could not sell to. But that only mattered in some instances. In others, the federal government was expected to act, such as in the case of abortion, which became another huge trigger. The Supreme Court became another trigger. Conservative leaders realized that they had a base that cared about the Supreme Court and that a potential Supreme Court pick was an easy way to get their supporters out for presidential elections, something that liberals still have not seemed to manage to get their base to be equally enthused about. Now, with all this in mind, the Conservative Party of the 1980s also noticed that they had been out of power in federal government for decades. Liberals controlled the legislative branch almost always, regardless of who was in the White House. There were moments where the two houses of Congress were split, but for the most part, liberals owned the legislative branch. It was at this time that a new school of thought was developed by the Conservative Party, a school of thought that was more confrontational, hyper-aggressive, and supported the idea of win at all costs. This was the resurgence of McCarthyism, a political ideology pioneered by Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s as a senator during the Second Red Scare. McCarthy leveled heavy communist accusations against his political opponents without any regard for the truth or facts or due process or the political norms of tolerance of the opposing party, a political norm that is extremely vital towards the maintenance of any democracy. The view that even though you have a different viewpoint than me, I still feel like you have the best interest of this country at heart, and you are not my enemy. This viewpoint was really summed up by the late John McCain when in a rally where his own audience of supporters were being extremely critical of Obama during their presidential campaigns against each other, when he had every opportunity to seize on that energy and galvanize his base even more, he chose to exercise and stay within the realms of political tolerance, that norm, when he stated, "Barack Obama is a good man. He just has different views than I do." Before McCarthyism was denounced and McCarthy ran out of politics in shame, he was a powerful and efficient attack dog of the Conservative Party, and he did notable damage to many liberal politicians and activists. And while the Conservative Party distanced itself from McCarthy, it did learn from what he was able to do by playing on people's fears and staying on the attack. In the 1980s, as young conservatives came up, tired of the losing ways of their party, they brought with them the understanding that politics was war and that the liberals were their enemies that needed to be destroyed. Backed by the evangelical and other church organizations, along with the pro-life movements and their built-in grassroots efforts, they started their pushback attacking Democrats with a very top-down approach to politics. They wanted to win at the top and allow that to trickle down to the lower levels. Nixon was their hero, and they saw his impeachment as confirmation that this nation was dying and the liberals were killing it. Their plan was simple. Attack the liberals, and to ensure that their own conservative base never forgot what the issues were and how important they were. So they began running attack ads that were extremely aggressive and extremely personal at the time in the 80s and 90s. They put liberals on the defense without ever letting up, and they maintained their identity as conservatives by continuing to sound the alarm on their key issues. By doing this, they maintained many different groups that make up the Conservative Party. They reminded them why they were all together, even when they disagreed on major political issues. They understood that most people only really care about a few issues at the expense of everything else. So what would, in theory, be a liberal evangelical was conservative because of the prioritization of their pro-life stance. In addition to the unity that they created by continuously pumping their issues and staying true to their identity. The fact that they also managed to always be on the attack meant that their liberal opponents never had the opportunity to regroup and define themselves. With the tremendous advantage of being able to dictate the political terms of engagement, they began utilizing the law to cement future power. Gerrymandering, which is a process of drawing voter districts, became extremely powerful as a tool in the hands of conservatives who drew districts that guaranteed that they would hold office in Congress through the foreseeable future. They also managed to win presidential elections at key moments, creating a Supreme Court that has been conservative-leaning for the last 30 years. This is supremely important as well because we'll use the modern example of gerrymandering as an example. They are currently facing Supreme Court cases all over the nation regarding the illegal gerrymandering along racial lines that they have utilized. And the Supreme Court that's going to hear these cases and make a decision is a Supreme Court that is conservative leaning. With regards to gerrymandering, not only did they cement their power, but they also effectively disengaged liberal voters who were increasingly becoming disillusioned with the voting process anyways. Feeling like their votes didn't matter, and gerrymandering has definitely reduced the impact of liberal voters, they stopped participating. This also works in favor of the Conservative Party, as they have always been a smaller portion of the American population. If they can have their base be galvanized while their opponents feel disillusioned, they can further cement their power. Low voter turnout is your friend when you are the smaller group, and the Conservative Party recognizes this, which is one of the reasons why they do everything in their power to make voting more difficult instead of easier. Utilizing coded language and abstract issues, they focus on things like voter fraud and voter ID laws, one of which is not really an issue. I mean, if we're being real, there has never been a study that's shown that voter fraud is a real thing. The other, which has been shown study after study, that it will negatively impact non-whites at a greater clip than it would negatively impact whites. The small funding needed to buy a state ID is a lot to someone who doesn't have enough money to buy proper food. And transportation is a whole other issue for those that are poor. And when you combine that with those that are poor, that are elderly, and that are in poor health, you get a situation where you disenfranchise a large portion of people, the bulk of whom are non-white. With modern technology, it would be easy enough to solve the voter fraud issue, provided it really existed, by making a system that's simply digital, a process which would also allow for increased security. But this top-down approach of winning at any cost can also be viewed in their news stations. Conservative news pioneered television programming designed to sway opinion more than to deliver facts. A study released by the Pew Research Center found that of all news outlets, Fox News, more than any other outlet, was designed not for maximum exposure, but for maximum political shifts. In other words, conservative outlets like Fox are designed to make you more conservative, not make you informed. So over the last 40 years, conservatives have defined themselves, united their various factions, and launched an all-out offensive with the goal of taking long-term control of the judicial and legislative branches, which wasn't until the mid-90s that the Conservative Party took total ownership of the legislative branch for the first time since the 1950s. By 2002, their top-down aggressive approach to politics had begun to bear major fruit on the local level. Bill Clinton's election galvanized them further, especially with his appointment of two Supreme Court justices, one of whom is one that we all love to talk about, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They fought tooth and nail to destroy Bill Clinton, defending their position as the party of family values by making his affair an impeachable offense. They also forced their presidential candidates to become pro-life in order to maintain the unity of their party. Going back to Reagan, all Republican candidates were pro-choice prior to their presidential run. All Republican presidents, I'm sorry. The election of President Obama returned the disenfranchised white supremacists to the conservative fold. A conservative Congress blocked nearly all legislative agendas and executive priorities, forcing him to rely heavily on executive orders and agreements that could be easily overturned by a conservative president. They blocked his judicial appointments and refused to hold a hearing on his final Supreme Court nomination with almost a full year left in his presidency. Another conservative Supreme Court judge would hold off on his retirement until a conservative was in the White House. By the end of Obama's term, 10% of judge openings remained unfilled. Some of those that were blocked by conservatives would later be confirmed after being renominated by a conservative president, Donald Trump. They had developed their identity and a plan of action, and it was working and continues to work. Which brings us back to the stats from the opening part of this show. They have control of all three branches of government on the federal level. The 33 governor's mansions that are lived in by Republicans effectively give them executive power at the local level in roughly 70% of the nation. 31 state legislatures are controlled. 31 state governments, are controlled by Republicans, with 26 states being in total control of Republicans compared to just 8 for Democrats. The rest have combinations of mismatching governors and legislators. The conservatives have been playing this game since the 80s against an opponent that is just now realizing nearly 40 years later that they are in a fight with an opponent that is trying to kill them. While the current conservative ideology might be different from the ideology of the 80s, they still seem to be following the same game plan. And why shouldn't they be? It's a game plan that has won them control of the government on all levels. And while we have had to leave out a lot of stuff, a lot of information in order to keep this thing within the time slots that we like to keep these things in, I hope the message has come across that this is something that has been happening and has been decades in the making. A long-term plan of action that has worked to perfection and will continue to work to perfection until liberals decide to stop being reactive and come up with a plan of their own. As a black person in America, I can't help but wonder the same thing about my people. When will we stop being reactive to white supremacy and come up with a plan of our own? Because right now, white supremacy controls every branch of government on every level.
Lessons from the screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.